Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plot Lines. I'm your host, Connor. And before we get to our episode today, please like, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you like this episode, please check out one of Plot Lines' other episodes. Now, today we're going to be talking about No Country for Old Men, which is a movie that came out, I think, in 2006, 2005 or 2006, something like that.
Yeah.
And Mark from Tradman is here to discuss that with me. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Connor. How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. It's been a while. We were discussing that a little bit since we've talked face to face.
It's too long. Too long, my brother.
Yes,
too long.
Too long. I've had your partner on. I think it was 2 weeks ago, 1 week ago. I don't remember.
He's good because he doesn't come on our show anymore.
Jason's hiding from your show. Well, he keeps going on Avoiding Babylon for the Chosen reviews.
No, and I'm glad he's able to do that. It's one of these things when you're a lay person and you've got your lay person job and you've got your podcasting as your hobby and your apostolate and you're kind of juggling all these things. And sometimes you just have to take a break from putting content out because you got other things going on. It's the way it is. But we appreciate all our subscribers hanging in there with us while we do take those breaks like that.
So this was a movie that you suggested me to watch to discuss.
So yeah, No Country for Old Men. Now, before we dig too deep into this, Connor and I were talking in the green room before this, and is it okay if I admit to them that this was not your favorite film?
I didn't say it wasn't my, well, okay. Yeah, it wasn't my favorite film, but that's not what I said.
Okay. I don't want to misquote you. Tell me what it is you.
I said it wasn't my type of film.
Okay. Okay.
Like it wasn't my genre specifically.
You're not alone is what I wanted to say. In preparation for this, my wife and I watched the film together and she was like, this is an awfully depressing and just nihilistic and just, you know, what is the point? This is a depressing film. I hate this. that certainly is present. So I want you to know you have every right to feel that way. And I get it. But to me, this film has certain, how can I start with No Country for Old Men? Where do I start? Growing up out here in Texas in the mid 80s, actually I grew up out all through the 80s. There was just a look and a smell to the place. I don't know quite how to say it. Prosperity was in the air, I guess, kind of a thing. One of the things that about this film that I loved is the costume, the setting, the scenery. They captured, they went to every detail. I thought I was looking at Texas in 1985 or whatever. The Southwestern Bell Yellow Page bills that Anton Chigurh looks at. I mean, we used to get those in the mail. It's one of those interesting things. So that I guess that's kind of what lured me to the film was sort of that Western imagery and Texas in the 80s. But what I found in the film was an interesting take on the Western genre itself. It is, I guess, in many ways, an anti-Western. Okay.
Well, can you explain what a Western is?
Because yeah,
that's actually, I didn't grow up watching Westerns, so yeah. I don't really know much about the genre.
Yeah. So Westerns in my, and this is a difficult thing to narrow down, but we'll go with the best like definition that I can offer you, which is a narrative that takes place during the time of the expansion of the American West, Manifest Destiny, whatever you want to call it. Let's call it the 1830s to about the turn of the 20th century, okay, of the American West period. After that, I think law and order is generally the norm, even out in places like Nevada and California and places like that. So
whether it's good law or not.
whether it's good law or not. So essentially the Western film genre to me is a depiction, is a morality tale. Because in the American West, you're left to decide justice for yourself. It's not an institutional apparatus that's already in place. Your mettle is tested every day, and justice will be meted out amongst each other, and only the strong will survive, you know. And the and if when to great risk goes great reward, because there's gold in them there hills, you know. Mm-hmm. So an honor-based society, at least in the imagination, in the mythos, emerges where a man's word is his bond. Emerges one of these things that we have in the American West, and that generated there is this unique job emerged. If you were going to herd a bunch of cows, cows are kind of stupid animals, and the ones on the outskirts of the herds tend to wander off into the woods. And getting a herd from one place to another, you lose your whole herd trying to do that. So you'd hire people whose whole job it was to sit on a horse and herd these cows back into the rest of the herd. And the person that you hired to do this was a young kid, typically around the age 13 to sometimes around 17, 18 years old. He was a boy, and the cowboy was born. And thus was a mythical folk hero, our version of the Bedouin, if you would, you know, who tames the wilderness on the wild frontier. But No Country for Old Men challenges the tropes that are used in the American Western. And I think at the end of the film, I think we see a redemption of the notion of defense of traditional values. Now, my wife disagrees with that notion, but we'll get there. Do you want me to break down the plot, the general plot? Should we say spoilers ahead and all that stuff?
Sure. Yeah. If you want to break down the plot, spoilers ahead.
And keep in mind, we're only talking about the film here. I'm not going to discuss the book because I haven't read the book. Now, okay, everybody calm down. The reason I haven't read the book is everybody has told me that the film is a very faithful adaptation of the book. So I haven't gotten to the book yet. I've just sort of put it off. I will get to it. But we're just talking about the film, and spoilers ahead. So if you haven't seen the film, go watch the film and then come watch this. No Country for Old Men tells the story of Llewellyn Moss, who has stumbled across a drug deal gone bad and $2 million left over from that drug deal. It tells the story of how he plans to escape with the money, his pursuit by various factions who plot to kill him. And in the process, I have a couple of philosophical things to say about morality and ethics and things like that, which I thought would be very interesting for plot lines. Now, first of all, this is a Coen Brothers film. Do you watch a lot of Coen Brothers films, Connor?
I don't know. To be honest, there aren't a lot of movies that I know their directors.
Okay. One of my favorite Coen Brothers films of all times is The Big Lebowski. There's also Fargo and, oh goodness, so many great Coen Brothers films. A Serious Man is a great film. But anyway, there are parallels between No Country for Old Men and another Coen Brothers film called The Big Lebowski. But I will skip those for now, knowing that you're not a big Coen Brothers guy.
it sounds like they're older movies.
No, I mean 90s, no. 80s, 90s,
that's 2000. Older movies for me.
You darn kids and your music.
I'm too young for you. You should have been like, you also need to watch these movies so we can, so there's a basis.
Jack says Anton Chigurh is one of the greatest of all time villains in fictions. In fiction, yes. I love Anton Chigurh. Anton Chigurh essentially is the principal protagonist of this. Okay. But he's
Lewin's not the protagonist.
What's that?
Or Llewellyn? Llewellyn is not the.
Did I say protagonist? Oh my goodness, I'm an idiot. Sorry. He is the antagonist.
I thought you had some like crazy thing to tell me.
Yikes. Yeah, that'd be bad. No. Okay. So Anton Chigurh, I wish I had a little picture of him I could show you. He has this very interesting appearance. Anton Chigurh is meant to look. He's meant to look ambiguous, out of place, strange, and at the same time a little bit menacing. He's got a kind of a strange haircut. He's usually dressed in black. He does not have expression or emotions on his face at all or anything like that. He kills randomly. And one of the things, there's always this discussion about, does Anton Chigurh really kill at random? What a strange looking villain. And the ambiguity continues even with his name. We're not quite sure, based on that name, where he's from. Mm-hmm. Is he Slavic? Is he Latin? Is he Texan? He could be one of these things. He's sort of unidentifiable. And to me, Anton Chigurh has always represented the way nature destroys and kills, right? When you think about like a tsunami or a plague or a pandemic or something like that, the idea that you can negotiate with it and play by its, if you play by a certain number of rules, you can escape whatever it is that it's got coming for you. Anton Chigurh kills like nature. And in fact, I think in one scene he's even actually compared to the bubonic plague, right? Mm-hmm. And that is, that's the way, the natural world is. And I remember one time I was watching a CNN thing because I was in the airport and that's what was on. CNN is like,
I'm so sorry.
Why won't Congress do something about asteroids?
What?
And I thought, what are they gonna do exactly? You ban asteroids?
It's illegal. It's the
stupidest thing I've ever. Yeah, it's illegal for an asteroid to come and hit us. Anton Chigurh presents a figure that. Okay, I'll play a game with you. What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss? Right, the coin toss game. Mm-hmm. So if I play this game. And I play it correctly and I win, I can escape my Anton Chigurh death. Indeed, we see that happen in an episode in the film.
Yep. Some store owner.
Yeah, the gas station owner. Yeah.
The gas station.
What's owner. The most you ever lost in a coin toss? He wins the coin toss game and survives. But then there are other times when Anton Chigurh inexplicably and for no reason kills people just at random.
Yeah.
So to me, Anton Chigurh represents the way that, I don't want to say that it's not evil necessarily. It's just, it's a force of nature kind of a thing. It's mm-hmm. what's coming. It's like a wave. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think he just makes an incredible, incredible villain. And Anton Chigurh also is paralleled to Llewellyn Moss in various ways. One of the first ways is that the first time that we meet Llewellyn, where he's hunting for the antelope. Right before that scene is the scene where we see Anton stop the motorist and kill him with the cattle gun.
Yeah, what kind of gun is that?
So that is that's a bolt stunner. And a bolt stunner is used. Oh, great. Of course, I'm out of LaCroix here. A bolt stunner is used to kill kill cattle. Okay. You put it up here, this little hydraulic pin shoots into the cattle's brain, shoots right back out. They never know what hit them, and it stuns them out and they die. It's actually a really efficient way to stun bees.
Supposed to be less painful?
Yeah, they're not. Yeah, they don't feel a thing.
What about for human?
What do you mean? Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, my guess would be that it would be pretty painless. Yeah.
Interesting.
To kill a human being like that.
Because it just instantaneous?
Yeah, it instantaneously just creates a hole in the brain, you know.
Yikes.
Yeah.
But then he uses other similar guns.
His shotgun that's got the silencer on it. And
was it a silencer? Oh, okay.
That makes sense. Yeah. And this film has also got some of the tensest action scenes of any kind of film like this that I've ever seen. I mean, the way that they just build tension with silence is incredible. It is really, really well done. Excuse me, in this film. What was your take on the film in terms of its overall message, Connor? What do you think the film was about?
I mean, first of all, don't get yourself into a situation you really don't know who you're dealing with.
Sure.
Like, Llewellyn did not know who was going to be coming after him. He just kind of found himself in a situation and decided to take it. Even though, like, at some points he seems very smart, but it's a really dumb thing for him to do on the face of it.
I have to. I was telling my wife, I was like, "Who in the world? If you came across a scene like that, you would you take that money?" I was like, "Heck no! I wouldn't want anything in the world to do with that money." I was like, "I might steal some of those guns." I don't know. They had some AKs laying on the ground there that I was like,
"Why would you steal some of the? Or why would you take some of the guns?"
I don't know, because I'm not that moral of a person, Connor. I'm trying, but.
Well, I would never get myself into that situation just because
the part where Llewellyn takes that nickel plated 1911 Colt 45 and he just takes that. And I saw that scene and I was like, yep, I do that.
is this a Texas thing too? Because
in terms of the guns. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a part of our culture for sure. No question about it.
I can't see a lot of like city, like a Californian would just freak out. Wouldn't take the guns whatsoever. Would be like, oh no. And then, basically it just wouldn't be something, you know, it wouldn't be a trophy for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in Texas, it might be a trophy.
Well, no, I wouldn't use this as a trophy. I just like the guns. They're just nice looking guns.
It would be something you. Okay. Maybe it's not a trophy. Maybe that's. But anyway, so I'm much more of a talking movie type of guy. So that may be it's difficult for you. It's a very silent movie in a lot of ways.
The dialogue is sparse, but I you have to admit what little dialogue there is pretty solidly written, I think. I mean, Javier Bardem's character is probably one of the greatest, like Jack said, one of the greatest villains that have ever graced the silver screen, I think.
I also had to get used to the accents.
Javier Bardem's accent?
No, like the Llewellyn.
Oh, the Texas accent.
Some of that Texas accent was harder for me.
What did you think of Tommy Lee Jones's character?
His character
and his accent.
Well, it's not Tommy Lee Jones's normal accent, obviously. Is it off or is it on point?
It's on point, man. That he's from San Saba, so that he's from that area with where they talk like that.
He just plays it down, I'm guessing, for
other films. I'm not sure.
Or just for, I don't think he talks like that on a regular basis.
He might, yeah, I'm sure he might have. I'm sure he might be his No Country for Old Men accent might be a little bit different than his normal speech. I'm not sure. But his character was also very interesting because his character reminded me a lot of, have you ever read W.B. Yeats's poem, The Second Coming?
No.
Okay. You got to know something about Irish people. They are fantastically morose and dark and like sort of just, they put you down in the dumps, these people.
that sounds like Irish people.
So William Butler Yeats is Ireland's poet laureate, right? Essentially one of the greatest Irish poets who ever lived. Can I read this short poem from him, if I may? And I want you to think a lot about No Country and think about Tommy Lee Jones's character in particular, Ed Tom Bell, the sheriff. And it goes like this. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dim tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with a lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it real shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born.
Yeah, I mean,
I need a drink after that. My goodness.
So Tommy Lee Jones's character is definitely sort of beaten down over the course. He's too old for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he would be a much more active character in the movie, in the story.
Yeah,
because in a lot of movies where he's up like a detective or a marshal or a FBI agent or something like that, he is the center of attention. Like, yeah. When I first started watching the movie, I thought, okay, we're going to see the crime or whatever, and then we're going to get the hunting down of the villain by the sheriff, but that's not really what we get.
Yeah, there was no, as my wife likes to point out, there was no denouement in this film. This film robbed us of our denouement. Essentially, in the Western, the Western has a couple of plot devices that were usually pretty present throughout Western films, especially the early ones in the 30s and 40s. They were some of the earliest examples of cinema in the country were Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
I think America's very first motion picture was called The Bank Robbery, and it was The Great Train Robbery, and it was a Western. One of them is, there is usually a MacGuffin. Do you know what a MacGuffin is? Have you ever heard that plot device before?
An object that is used to move along a plot.
There you go. Yeah. And it's almost always a suitcase of money.
Okay? in a Western.
In a Western, it typically is. And if you're looking for a MacGuffin, if you're writing a story and you can't quite think of something, the old fallback is always usually a suitcase of money, right? Mm-hmm. So you have that present. You also have the presence of white hats and black hats. So, and that is present throughout No Country for Old Men too. Llewellyn Moss, Sheriff Ed Tom Bell, and Carlson, Woody Harrelson's character, whose name now forgets, has completely escaped me. Carlson.
He's not in it there. Wells.
Carson Wells. Yeah, Carson Wells. I love suitcases with money. Hope to have one day. Yeah, no kidding.
It's nice we have Jason kidding. Watching.
What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss? So yeah, and so that's one of the themes that you see. There are also, you know, themes like cowboy hats, horses, gunshot, you know, gunfights and things like that. Those are all present throughout this film, and they turn the Western on its head, because in the Western, at the end, you always get the showdown with the bad guy. There's high noon out in the street.
Yeah, that's completely taken out.
Justice is going to be meted out one way or the other, and in this film, we don't get it. So why? Why was there no resolution to this story?
Is it because it's a modern take or something like that?
Okay, so what I think McCarthy... Now, William McCarthy was the writer of the book. And again, let's assume that the film is a pretty faithful adaptation to the novel. This is a statement about our modern problem in the world. Nobody takes any responsibility for justice. Okay. Even Ed Tom Bell throughout most of the film sort of have this attitude of, yeah, somebody ought to deal with this. You know, he doesn't, as Yeats's poem says, the best lack all conviction. And Meanwhile, you have Anton Chigurh, the worst, who is full of passionate intensity. And while it is true he kills without any particular emotion, he is incredibly efficiently lethal in comparison to Ed Tom Bell or any of the good guys, the white hats in this scenario.
Man, you know, Anton Chigurh is, you know, he's wearing usually darker clothing, so it works out perfectly with that.
Hey, Brick, I see you, man. I ask about you all the time, dude. Yeah, Brick, I totally agree. This is a fantastic. Again, I'll only talk about the film, but it's a fantastic.
Yeah, he hasn't story. Seen or he hasn't read the book.
I haven't read the book yet. Getting there, working on it.
Well, you just said you didn't have a reason to.
No, what I meant to say was, I'm okay having not read it yet. But I want to talk about the film anyway, and then sure. I feel like I will get to the book.
Okay.
Come on, man. Come on, man. Tommy Lee Jones gives an interesting closure to this film, and I'm not saying we got to wrap up our discussion or anything here, but his close to the film, where he talks about the dream he has, I think sums up a lot about what this film has to say about what's wrong with the modern world. He talks about his father in both dreams, and I would absolutely argue that the problem with the modern world is a crisis of fatherhood. But he talks about his father in both dreams. It says, the first dream, I borrowed some money from him. I think I lost it. I don't know. Not important. But the second dream, it was like we were in olden times, back in the Westerns, right? It was like we were in the Western times. And we were on horseback. And it was cold and it was dark, and he was riding up ahead of me, carrying in a horn a fire. And I knew that he was going up to make a fire in all that cold and all that dark, and that he'd be there when I got there. I feel like what we're seeing now, because the whole film, he's constantly talking about what is the deal with crime these days. He says the crime you see nowadays is hard to even take its measure. And you know, who are these people? And it's all out war and things like that. He just can't deal with how random and brutal modern crime is. And so we have a crisis of fatherhood, in the sense that we don't ride out in that darkness to build that fire anymore. And I kind of feel like if we would do that a little bit more, if we would assume a little bit more of that responsibility, the world might not be such a dark place after all. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Is there something specific like police don't take responsibility?
All of us.
What?
I would say all of our institutions have failed.
Mm-hmm.
All of our institutions have failed. And we just sort of sat back and watched it happen. And so now it's up to us as individuals, you know, to take care of one another, take care of ourselves, and not delegate our responsibilities to ourselves and our neighbors, because it's convenient or, you know, yeah, or easy to do.
Do you think there's something specific about the Woody Harrelson's character and Llewellyn are both Vietnam vets?
Yeah, like, I do.
Like, there's something, like Vietnam vets, there's a specific sort of aftermath for Vietnam vets, at least that's popularized, you know, sort of the generation that wasn't welcomed home, you know, after fighting war. Because previously, if a generation went off to war, they would welcome home with open arms, and people were there and celebrated them and blah, 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 you know, that sort of thing. But Vietnam was the end of that.
Yeah.
They stopped that.
I have a weird theory, and this is just a fan theory, and there's no way to confirm or, you know, what any of this is just a weird what if, but what if Anton Chigurh was also a Vietnam vet? I mean, it might explain why, as Carson Wells said, because he knows Anton Chigurh, quote, every which way. They're close. They're close. They're buddies. They've known each other from something. Mm. We also know from one of the scenes that Anton Chigurh has specialized medical training. He's obviously able to heal his own combat wounds, which were quite severe. Yeah. So he's got some kind of specialized, forensic medical trauma training. We know that Carson and both Llewellyn are Vietnam veterans, and it would make sense if Anton was part of that too. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Also, it just shows it, in some ways, since society didn't take basically society didn't accept, you know, maybe you know, everyone sees Vietnam as a mistake, and you know, let's just take it as if it is a mistake, and it probably was a mistake. But the whole point of the response to soldiers coming back from Vietnam is that they are rejected by society. Now, society doesn't take any responsibility for the war that it just partook in.
Yeah.
You know, basically people are always on the side of like, okay, like there's some people, I guess some, so I mean, there was this the anti-war left kind of that existed during the Vietnam War, and that basically rejected the premise of the people that that went to war as being worthwhile, as being worth it. But instead of viewing like the war as being not worth it, they seem to turn that towards the human, the and not take responsibility. Basically, there's half the people that say this wasn't my thing. I didn't ask for this, so I'm not going to take responsibility for this. And then there's the other half of the people who maybe probably pushed for it, but they're not going to take responsibility for it either because it doesn't benefit them from taking responsibility for it. And that sort of puts people in these different camps that sort of brings them, pushes them to do these different types of things. So like running off and catching $2 million, you know, finding $2 million and not, you know, turning it in or not doing anything, but wanting to run off with it basically. Because if you're sort of been spit out by the world, you don't feel like anyone's there to help you. You're just going to be out for yourself.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of maybe where the like the cold and calculated comes from with Anton as well, as he's been spit out by the world. If he's also a vet, and what is Woody Harrelson's character? What's his what does he do? And what does he do for a living?
Yeah, so it's not clear exactly what a title would be. I guess I would call him a bounty hunter, in a sense. But yeah, it's not clear exactly what his job is. But we know that he is a somebody you call when you're out of options and you got to get rid of somebody. Cause he says, so somebody asks him how dangerous is this Anton Chigurh? He says, well, he's dangerous enough. You called me. So that to me, I guess means like he specializes in sort of, you know, cleaning up runaway problems that, you know,
so in a sense, is he trying to take responsibility or no?
No, he's all about the money.
Yeah.
He's all about the money. In fact, when confronted with Anton, he offers Anton the money, offers to take him to an ATM and give him his employer's money and then tuck tail and run. You know, now a lot of people have said that Anton had some sort of a code that you can determine what Anton is going, if he's going to kill you or not. So like, because Carson Wells was such a little, you know, sniveling little baby, when he was sitting there facing the end of the gun, threatening to buy it, trying to find a way to buy his way out of this, he kills Carson Wells, but he doesn't kill the woman, at Llewellyn Moss's trailer complex. Remember?
Yeah. So
he goes up and he says, where does Llewellyn Moss work? And she says, well, I can't give out no information on our residents. He says, where does he work? Kind of threaten her. She says, sir, we can't give out no information. So
why do you think he doesn't kill her?
I think, yeah, that's the question. Some people will say because she was honest with him and kept her, you know, he respected her gangster, basically. She held her ground and didn't, you know.
Well, but why did he kill the wife at the end? That seemed pointless.
Yeah. Because Anton Chigurh is like a force of nature. Okay. This is what I kept telling everybody when coronavirus first came out. Well, we've got to wear these masks. No, you can't wear those, man. You got to wear these other masks over here. Everybody's got to get, the vaccine. Everybody's got to get this vaccine. Everybody can't get the other vaccine. This is a force of nature you're talking about here. Okay. It's like trying to stop those tsunamis. We believe that because we're so, because we're these modern human beings that we just have total mastery over nature. But don't forget, God created light. He called the darkness day and the light. The light day and the darkness night. Thank you. My goodness. So God names the light day and the dark night. That means he has dominion over nature, right? Yeah. He's the master of life and death. I think sometimes we think we are. Anton Chigurh reminds me of that type of, it's an ungovernable force, man. You can't stop it. What's going to happen is going to happen. And indeed, we're finding out now that most, if not all, of the precautions that we did during COVID-19 were basically pointless. Didn't make it worse. And that was my whole point. It's like trying to ban asteroids. It's absurd.
Yeah,
some point. And so that's what that is one of the things that I liked about Chigurh's character is he's so unidentifiable. We can't tell where he's from. We can't tell exactly anything about his personality or him personally. But let's see here. Who has love the hat? I have matching boxers. Thank you, Gregory. yikes. But yeah, that's right. That's been reporting to Catholic simps right there. I'm just kidding, Greg. But yeah, no, Anton, there's no personality there. And so that in a sense makes it more chilling because there's no weaknesses there to be exploited. And there's no, if somebody has a personality, then even a twisted person laughs once in a while or cries or goes through emotions or has weak points or things like that. But Anton Chigurh just doesn't have those things. And he's so violent. You know what I mean? Like the first mm-hmm. killing he does happens in like the first 5 minutes of the film. And it is so violent and so graphic and so hard to watch. I often skip that scene nowadays. After having seen it once, I know what it is and I skip it because it is very hard to watch. And the way he just gets up after that, just sort of he goes and he washes his hands and
yeah, he just doesn't care.
No regard for human life at all.
What do you think of Brick seeing him as the angel of death?
Yeah, there's something to that because like I said, he's always in black. So he's, even though he doesn't appear in a hat necessarily, he's the black hat, right? Mm-hmm. Of the Western trope.
I think it's funny. The mother of the wife.
Yes.
She's the reason that the Llewellyn gets killed.
Right. Right.
Which is kind of crazy. I mean, she doesn't know anything.
Yeah. It all kind of happens by accident. And I hear tell that this is one detail that and where the book was a little different. So if anybody in the comment section can confirm or not that.
Basically, Brick, is that different? Is it different in the
book? Is that different in the book? The details exactly about Llewellyn's death.
This is his mother-in-law. Is his mother-in-law really the
I understand that the mother-in-law thing was still correct, but if you remember the young lady who was trying to flirt with Llewellyn at by the pool of the motel where Llewellyn eventually is killed, do you remember?
Yeah,
I remember her. Yeah, and I remember the book has that interaction going on over a period of multiple days.
Okay.
But he does maintain his marital integrity, and he doesn't fornicate with her or anything like that. So
is she a plant?
No. Okay. No. Not in the book, as I understand. Of course, in the film, that part is left ambiguous. So
yeah, we don't really know. We don't really know how that all went down.
Right. And that's another part of the film, is that you in real life, you don't get resolution to all of life's issues and kerfuffles. The kerfuffles, you know, but
all those kerfuffles.
Yeah. All those cartel kerfuffles that you get into, you know, I mean, listen, we've all been there, right? You're walking around in the desert. You come across a suitcase full of $2 million. Dead guys everywhere.
Well, that's like nothing nowadays.
Beautiful cartel gats just laying all over the ground. You know what I mean? For the taking. We've all
taken the guns.
But yeah, no.
Also, why is like Llewellyn living in like a trailer park? He seems like he should be better off, I guess.
Why?
He has a lot of skills, it seems like.
Well, yeah, but like you pointed out, a lot of guys after the army, especially after Vietnam, found it difficult to find work. Found it difficult to PTSD was a problem. Yeah. He clearly has combat training, and when he recounts his service record to the border crossing agent. He lists himself as being in the infantry. So he clearly got combat. He's clearly got all these. Let's see here. Yeah, he does all these extravagant murders and death. Pretty violent times, but sometimes people are spared for seemingly no reason. Right, exactly. And that's like, force of nature. In fact, he's actually even compared to the bubonic plague by Carson Wells. The man was asking Carson, how dangerous is this? Is this Anton Chigurh? And he goes, this is compared to what? The bubonic plague?
Right. What's interesting is when Anton gets hit by the car, when he's driving, I thought someone like was going to be in the car.
Yeah.
Like that was such a letdown. I thought like, someone who's going to come out and like kill him or something.
I think the point is that it was a glimmer of hope. To me, it was a glimmer of hope, letting the audience know that this chance and randomness that the White Hats see themselves subjected to in this film over and over again, the Black Hats are subject to it too, and they will get their comeuppance. Now, this is where I disagree with the assertion of the film. I do not believe that life is a random and absurd collection of, you know, chaotic moments that sometimes work out, sometimes don't. I actually do subscribe to the belief in a grand divine narrative, you know, that is the will of God the Father. That's my religion talking, and that, you know, but of course it's one of the things that I look off to. Let's see here, put that Kevin Protzman that one on here. I had to drop off due to computer problems, but did you guys talk about how Anton drinks milk? There are a few films where the sociopathic villain drinks milk. Why? Very great question. And there is a video on this that I do want to watch and I haven't yet about milk. Milk is a drink that denotes at the same time childlike innocence, but also blandness and featurelessness, right?
What if it's chocolate milk?
Oh man, I don't know about that. That's racist, bro. No, I'm kidding. No idea.
Yet white milk is bland, and that's why, not racist.
Why has it got to be white milk, Connor? What, you know? Come on.
Well, man. It's chocolate. Whatever.
I don't know either. Yeah, no, I haven't talked about that yet, but like,
I think it's just people can make very creepy scenes watching people drink milk.
Yeah.
There's something scary about that.
Yeah, it's unsettling to watch, isn't it? My people are bland. We know this. you know, you every time you see Anton, though, you do see him mirrored with a white hat, either Sheriff Ed Tom Bell or Llewellyn Moss. And the scene with the milk is no different. We see Anton sitting in the couch, staring at the TV. He's silhouetted against the TV. Very next scene, we see Ed Tom Bell sitting in that exact same seat, holding that exact same milk, being silhouetted in the TV that exact same way.
He does drink milk too. Tommy Lee Jones does drink milk after, yes. After Anton drinks milk. So that's something.
Right, right.
So it's not just villains that drink milk.
No. Yeah, that's true. It does a body good. but yeah, it's a very interesting thing because one of the ways in which those two juxtaposition things happen is in the beginning when we're introduced to Llewellyn Moss. The scene we've seen before we see Llewellyn is where Anton Chigurh kills the motorist by the highway with the bolt stunner. In that scene, we see somebody treat a human being like an animal. Okay. And with cold callousness, take his life away from him in a way that's very disturbing to watch. Very next scene, we see Llewellyn Moss, a white hat. And he has carefully stalked his prey, whereas Anton has lured his into a trap under false pretense. Very different, right?
I thought it was also interesting. Why does the guy not figure out, first of all, that Anton's not a cop? It seems pretty obvious what he's wearing. He's not a cop.
Maybe he's undercover.
But he wouldn't be driving the car.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
he's driving a cop's car, but he's not wearing any uniform whatsoever. He's just wearing, you know, black pants, a black coat. That's about it. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't have assumed that was a cop coming up beside me, because if you didn't see him come out of the car, you just saw some random guy come up to your, you know. You know what I mean? Like, I would have been on edge. Maybe that's just you're watching a film. It just makes you think, oh, this guy's definitely evil. If you know, a little bit, if you know you're in a film, it's a little different than when you're sort of caught off guard. But
yeah, and you've also got to put yourself in the mentality of somebody in West Texas in 1984.
Okay, well, put me in. Can you do that?
We weren't thinking about guys who've stolen cars and that are killing people with bolt stunners. Things like that were not crossing our minds. I mean, we had never even heard of, you know, I don't want to say
like the drug rings around there.
Well, all of that was happening in Mexico, though.
But it didn't come up into Texas?
The violence. Well, see, and that's one of the things that's starting to happen around this time. And so, you know, obviously the film taking place in that area is part of that. The narrative is part of that story about how this is starting to happen. But
El Paso seems like it can, like, I don't know where it takes place right in the beginning of the movie.
So what's it's in Terrell County, which is on the border. It takes place there. I think the seat of Terrell County is Sanderson, Texas. And it's just a cute little town if you've ever been down there. I would also recommend checking out Del Rio, where that famous shootout scene with Anton Chigurh and Llewellyn Moss take place.
Oh, but I do love that both Llewellyn and Anton run into like a bunch of kids after they get like injured two separate times.
Right.
I think that's an interesting like how.
And in both times, they're like, give me your shirt. Can I, you know, in both
yeah, instances. Yeah, well, one's like, give me your jacket. The other one's like, give me your shirt.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But it's just kind of funny. It's like, the kids are so, like, they're not jackasses, you know. One of them is, like, a little bit. But, like, they're relatively helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they don't. Yeah, the kids on the bridge want money.
Yeah,
and the kids, the younger kids were, well, heck, Mister, I'll give you my shirt. You know.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't need anything.
Yeah, and that. So there's the dichotomy between treating people between humanity and inhumanity runs very deep throughout this whole film. That's one of those things, like we were talking about with Anton Chigurh, treating somebody like an animal and hitting them with the bolt stunner versus the care to which Llewellyn is going in this hunting that he's on to kill his prey swiftly and humanely, but he didn't manage to do it correctly. And Llewellyn chasing him down so he could put him down ended up putting together a series of events that put in motion a series of events that would lead to his death. And it's this tendency towards virtue that continues to get Llewellyn into trouble, him bringing water back to the scene of the shootout, sending his wife away so he doesn't get her hurt. Remember when he's in the taxi cab going back up to his hotel and he tells the cabbie, take me to another hotel. Mm-hmm. And the cabbie says, I don't want to get into a jackpot here. He says, you're already into a jackpot and I'm trying to get you out of one, you know?
Mm-hmm. Also, please, everyone listening, please like, share, comment, and subscribe. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, definitely. And go over to Tradman and like us too.
Yes, definitely. Go to Tradman. If you look in the description, you'll find a Tradman link to go to their YouTube channel. So, so it's definitely the messaging really is if you do good things, you're going to get yourself killed. Basically.
And then it steps up to, I would say, a little scene from, remember the scene with Uncle Ellis?
Yeah.
So Tommy Lee Jones, Sheriff Ed Tom Bell, goes to see his Uncle Ellis. He's an older generation of law enforcement officer. And, you know, he's an old West Texas type guy, been there for a while. And they have a conversation that is straight out of Ecclesiastes. I mean, it reinforces this idea that you can't stop what's coming because it's not all waiting on you. You know, there are things that this whole thing that's set in motion that we call reality, real life. It is what it is. And you've got to be tough or you won't make it through the other side of it. This is very much a film for me that ought to inspire men to become tougher people. be tougher. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They talk about a story in that scene about how his Uncle Mac was gunned down on his front porch by Indians. And his wife dug a grave for him in the caliche, which is like a kind of a clay chunky type of earth caliche. He's digging in that hard old caliche. They dug a grave for him and buried him, man, the very next day. And people lived hard lives out there because you had to. The frontier was no joke. And yeah.
And the life we're living is so much easier.
So much easier.
But we complain probably way more.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely do complain a lot more. And we make a lot of we try to make a lot of compromises with evil, believing that generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Yeah. Yeah. Try to make a lot of compromises with evil, but at the end of the day, you know, they're not making any compromises. They want total victory. So you can't be naive about that. We think complaining is a virtue. Yeah, we do. We do. Yeah. I don't really have much more else to say. It's one of my favorite films. It's definitely my favorite Western.
Yeah, it's I think I need to watch more Westerns. If you want to give me a list of Westerns I need to watch, we can do that, and I'll try and get around to that.
Yeah, I
because it's kind of weird starting with the anti-Western.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it is.
At least it's harder for me to grasp. I mean, I kind of get the general nature of it because I've watched a little bit of small town detective or sheriff in New York or whatever. It's a comedy show.
Justified?
No.
I don't know. I don't. I know that Justified is a show. I've never seen it, but
no, this is like really old.
In New York.
No, upstate New York. Like it's
the commish.
No, it's with the guy plays a lawyer in later movies.
Brick, the Cowboys from 1972 with John Wayne. Is that the one you're talking about?
No, this is a TV show. I can't.
I'm talking about Brick in the comments.
He said, yeah, the Cowboys from 1972.
With John Wayne. Is that the one you're talking about? Yes, sir. Come on, Brick. What you know about that, son? Come on, Brick.
Oh, I can't. Yeah. It's with Ron Howard as the kid.
Oh, you're talking about.
It's kind of a Western. Even though it doesn't take place in the West. I get that it doesn't take place in the West, but it's kind of a Western in some sense.
Anthony and Opie and... No, Opie and...
Yeah.
What's the name of that show? Little... What's the name of that stupid show? It's going to drive me nuts.
See, this is why I can't do it either. So, okay. You would say it's not...
Gregory McKinnon, you are a fool, sir. I hear... I hear Brokeback Mountain is highly recommended by the USCCB.
Only McCarrick.
Oh, you're wrong for that. You're wrong for that, sir.
McCarrick endorses.
Brick, talk to me about The Outlaw Josie Wales. You know you love that movie, Brick. The Outlaw Josie Wales, man. If you like Clint Eastwood, you need to holler at me. Now, if you like The Duke, The Cowboys is a good movie, but my favorite John Wayne movie is Hondo. Yeah, Hondo was my favorite. Quick and the Dead, yeah, man.
Okay, well,
Tombstone,
I guess
Tombstone.
I have a lot of work to do.
All right, fine.
What do you mean? I just have so many. I have a lot of Western movies to catch up on.
But I also like Young Guns and Young Guns too.
Andy Griffith Show. Thank you.
The Andy Griffith Show. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's not Western.
Well, it's not.
No. but it's
the closest thing I can think of.
Gunsmoke was Western.
Well, I haven't watched that.
Kevin, you know, there was a Kevin Pratzman, if you're still in the chat, there was another great Western show about a guy in a Union fort, who all of his buddies were killed except him. And so he was branded. Yeah. You know about branded. So if you ever get around to watching another Coen Brothers classic, the Big Lebowski, then you'll be able to keep up with what 90% of me and Kevin Pratzman's conversations, because it's all Big Lebowski quotes.
maybe I'll have to watch that movie and we'll have to talk about it.
Oh, the Big Lebowski is...
All I know is that it's basically what Thor became in the Avengers Endgame.
I didn't see any of that.
He's called the Big Lebowski.
Oh, no, I didn't see any of that.
Because he's fat and he looks like the character. I don't know. I am
not Lebowski. You're Lebowski, okay? I'm the dude. So that's what you call me.
Anywho, go check out Tradmen, the Tradmen podcast. Mark and Jason are always doing awesome stuff. So go subscribe over there. Subscribe here. And look out this week. I'm going to be having Father Lovell on to discuss canceled priests. So look out for that. Anything you want to say, Mark?
I hope that you'll have me back on the show. I don't know if this was really, I hope you like this episode. Was this a good episode? Did you like
it?
So. Okay, good.
I could talk to you about anything.
All right, cool. No, I really like your show and I like coming on. So don't kick me off.
I'll try not to. Well, thank you, everyone.
All right, my brother. God bless.
Have a good evening.
Take care.